We've heard the reading on the Sangha in the Pure Land, Sukhavati. And I said yesterday that the Sukhavati as a symbol is a mega or meta symbol with lots of symbols inside it. And it symbolizes many things. And I talked yesterday about two things that I think it symbolizes. One is irreversibility. And the other is, well, three things actually, the Dharma Niyama and also the deathless, which is quite a lot to encompass in one symbol, isn't it? But also, interestingly, in the Eternal Legacy, when Bhante groups together the Mahayana Sutras under Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, the ones that are in the Sangha section are the Vimalakirti Nidesha and the three Pure Land Sutras. So, and I think he's right. You're right this time, Bhante. As well as all the other things that these, the symbol of the Pure Land represents, it represents the Sangha. And as I wrote in my book, on the big picture I've got on my wall of the Pure Land is absolutely teeming with beings. It's a picture of Sangha as much as it's a picture of trees and lotus ponds. Yeah, so, and as I said earlier on in this retreat, I understand the longer Sukhavati Vyuha Sutra as being more or less, roughly, divided into three parts. The first part is the Buddha. Well, it's the Bodhisattva as well. It's the Bodhisattva Dharmaka becoming the Buddha. And then the second part, the middle part, is the Dharma, the description of the Pure Land. And then this part is the Sangha. And it goes on a bit longer, actually, but I didn't want to overstretch you. But there's a little bit more on the Sangha, which if I've got time today, I'll say a bit more about the bit you didn't hear. So the last bit is about the Sangha. And so, in a way, what we were doing just now was Sanghanusati. We were recollecting, we were imagining. Anu means with, and sati is mindfulness or recollection, actually, recollection. So we were recollecting the Sangha. More properly speaking, we were imagining. We were imagining the Sangha in Sukhavati. And although it's supposed to be the Sangha, the Arya Sangha, actually, it's more like a description of a whole load of Buddhas, fully enlightened beings. It's more like a Buddha, a collective Buddhanusati practice there. And how many? It'd be interesting to know how many of you felt slightly, or maybe a lot, intimidated and demoralized and felt bad about yourself in comparison to those wonderful beings. Put your hands up if anything like that happened to you. My goodness. Well done you, that's good. Because it's the kind of thing that can tip people into a bit of a depression because they're not like these beings. So let me just say a few words about the Anusati practice. There are three Anusatis, and there's a list of six Anusatis, and then there's a list of 10 Anusatis. You know about the first three, Buddha, Dharma, Sanghanusati. But the next list, the next three, are very interesting. The next one is Silanusati, where you recollect your ethical actions. And the next one, I can't remember the exact term for it, but it's recollection of your generosity. It's not Dananusati, it's a word beginning with C, which I can't remember, but it's basically the recollection of your own generous acts. And the sixth one is recollection of the gods. So why recollection of the gods? Well, if you're ethical and you're generous, you'll be reborn as a god. Very, very simple. But it's quite interesting. How do you do the Silanusati practice? You recollect your ethical actions. Now, what we often do, as soon as we do that, the first thing that comes to mind is we recollect the fact all our unethical actions, all our lapses. In fact, it becomes a kind of confession an inner confession, because, oh yeah, I was a bit ethical, but I was very unethical there, and so on and so on. And the same with generosity, that as soon as we start thinking about any generous acts, we think, well, I could have been more generous, actually. I held back a bit there. Or you immediately think of something where you go, a situation you were quite mean. Yeah. Talking to you here. So this is what we tend to do. And I was at Gufiloka 3 or 4 years ago now on a long retreat, and I was leading some study, and we did a bit of study on the 10 the Dasadama Sutta, you know, from the Pali Canon, where you know, if you've gone forth, these are the things you should be doing. And it turned into a bit of a, you know, oh, that's, yeah, we don't do that, do we? Oh, no, we're not doing that properly, and we should do more of that. And I began to realise that we were really, it was becoming a bit down. So one day I said, okay, today I want you to go and reflect in pairs on the good things about yourselves, your ethical actions and your generosity and so on and so on, because I know you've got those qualities. And we did. And one pair came back and we reported back and they said, oh, we didn't do it. Why didn't you do it? Well, we didn't want to big ourselves up. So this is what we do with ourselves, isn't it? We don't like to talk about the good things about ourselves because we feel that's bigging ourselves up. But the Anusati practices are meant to be joyful and inspiring. They're not meant to be a downer. You're not meant to compare yourself unfavourably with these beings. And there's a line in the Vimalakirti Nidesha where Vimalakirti, there's this long praise of bodhisattvas. Well, actually, it's a praise of himself. Because somebody asked him, where's your house? And where's your wife? And where are your servants? Because he's sitting in this empty place, isn't he? Emptiness. And he says, you know, well, my house is, I can't remember now, but, you know, my house is the six perfections and all that kind of thing. And in that, there's just one line where he says, bodhisattvas do not dwell for very long on the difference between themselves and the Buddha. Which is interesting, isn't it? They don't dwell for very long on the difference, because if you dwell on the difference, you begin to feel despondent. And it's interesting in this reading today, I don't know if you noticed, that the bodhisattvas do not become despondent. Yeah, they're not intimidated by the Dharma. So that's a quality that is a good thing to have. So because we tend to have this downer on ourselves, I'm very, very pleased to hear this morning that none of you had that downer, because it has happened when we've done this reading with other people. They've come out feeling a bit battered by it and a bit demoralised and a bit intimidated. And because of that, I began to think about it, and then I remembered the Shortest Sukhavati Vyuha Sutra. You probably remember this too. Towards the end, after that whole section where the Buddha talks about all these Buddhas in the 10 directions, and they all cover their world system with their tongue, and then they describe it, and they all praise their own Buddha field. And then the Buddha says, Shariputra, just as I praise the inconceivable good qualities of those Buddhas, etc., etc., those blessed ones praise my inconceivable good qualities. And they say, the blessed one Shakyamuni, the king of the Shakyans, has done something which is very difficult to do. In the world system called Earth, he has attained unsurpassed perfect awakening and taught the Dharma to the whole of that unreceptive world. The word, I can't remember the Sanskrit for unreceptive now, but Shudapa told me it can also mean hostile. The whole of that unreceptive or hostile world. In a degenerate age, to degenerate beings with degenerate views, degenerate lifespans and degenerate defilements. And that comes up again in the reading you just heard. You've got these beings in Sukhavati. Yeah. The bodhisattvas who have been born in Sukhavati will be able to see the Buddha and hear the Dharma until they awakening, they attain awakening. They will be able to recollect their previous births, with the exception of those who have previously resolved to appear in the midst of the five kinds of degeneration, the same five, in the period of the dissolution of an aeon, when Buddha's blessed ones appear in the world, as I, this is Shakyamuni speaking, as I have appeared here. So it comes up again. Now, these five degenerations are often thought of as the generations of the third age of the Dharma, the age of Mappo, when it's a really bad time for the Dharma and you can't really practice anymore. We're so far away from the Buddha. But here, it's used in the present. In the shorter Sukhavati Viyuha Sutra, it's used when the Buddha, Shakyamuni, is actually teaching. And he's done something very difficult to do, which is to teach human beings on earth. And I was thinking, what the whole myth of having pure lands and impure, and this impure land, and we're only ever told about the one impure land, which is this one. I'm sure there are other impure lands as well, but we're never told about those. We're only told about these pure lands. And what it does is it creates a duality. I was reading the other day that Bansi said that Buddhism is neither a metaphysical dualism nor a monism. But actually what the Mahayana did with the idea of pure lands and impure lands, they created a dichotomy, a duality. You've got the pure land and you've got the impure land. And we're in the impure land. And then, of course, they had to resolve that dichotomy. And it's resolved, in a way, in the first chapter of the Vimalakirti Nidesha. You remember where the Bodhisattva Ratnaka and the 500 youths, they come to the Buddha. And Ratnakara asks the Buddha how to embrace a Buddha field. And there's a long... He gives a very long answer to that, and towards the end of that answer he says that the purity of the Buddha field is dependent on the purity of the Buddha. So Shariputra thinks, actually he doesn't think, the Buddha makes him think this magically. He makes him think, oh, well, this is an impure land, so that means the Buddha's mind must be impure. And then, as you know, the Buddha outs him, and basically, the end result is that Shariputra only sees this world as impure because his mind's impure. If his mind were pure, he'd see the world, this world as it is, which is pure. So that resolves this dichotomy into one. And that was a very popular idea in Japan and China. The famous song of meditation by Hakuin, where he says, this very place... the lotus paradise, this very body, the Buddha. So you get this dichotomy and then it's resolved back into one. But I don't think the Sukhavati Viyuha Sutras do that. Sukhavati is not really this place seen aright. Sukhavati, in the Sukhavati Viyuha Sutras, it's another place. There's a suggestion in the Guanjing that isn't quite the end of the story, but we'll get on to that tomorrow. But you get this duality, and I think that's a good thing. And I'm going to argue for that being a good thing now. Now, recently I've been reading a very interesting writer, a Christian, a theologist, a professor at a university in America, who's himself an Eastern Orthodox Christian. And when I go to Waterstones, I like to poke around in the religious section, not look at the Buddhist section, because it's all same old, isn't it? Dalai Lama, Thich Nhat Hanh, all those guys are there, and I'm not interested in them. But I go to the Christian section, I'm much more interested in those, because I've come across some really, really good Christian writers. And I found another one recently called David Bentley Hart, and I picked up this book called The Experience of God. And I'm not going to recommend it to you, because I recommended it when I was in Bristol recently, and an order member told me he bought it and he found it far too difficult. And it is a difficult book, but I thought it was worth ploughing through it, because he's highly intelligent. this guy is much, much more intelligent than me, and I'm sort of trying to follow. But it was so compelling that I managed to read the whole thing. But then after that, I wanted to read another book, and most of his books are really expensive because he's an academic, you know, like £35, and you have to be really sure about buying a book if you want to spend that much money. But then I found some of his lesser expensive books, which are just essays and articles he's written for various, I suppose, Christian periodicals put together. So I bought one of these on Kindle, and it's just various things that he'd written. And there's this lovely one called Farewell to a Mountain. And it's all about, it's just a little piece about the fact that he and his family used to live at the foot of a mountain and how wonderful that was. And he waxes eloquent about the beauty there. And then at the end of that, he says, the reason I'm telling you is because we've just had to move because we've had another child and the house is too small. So we've had to move away from the mountain. And he's kind of sad about that. And then he says, I keep one photograph among all those I have taken here these last 2 years, framed and displayed on my desk at all times, because it captures for me the feeling of the place most completely. I took it soon after our arrival here, as my son, aged 10 at the time, was watching the sunset for the first time from our porch over the small open glade to our southwest. He appears in it in silhouette, gazing up in wonder into the ruby and amethyst gulf of twilight over the enormous pines and the distant ridge. At least at the moment, it seems to capture something for me, a mood at once of delighted wonder and deep sadness that is inseparable from this place. It's one of the reasons I really love this man as a writer. Seems to capture something for me, a mood at once of delighted wonder and deep sadness. How brilliant it is that someone's managed to notice that that can happen, delighted wonder and deep sadness at the same time. It's so familiar to me, that feeling of watching a sunset and feeling this sense of melancholy, but also beauty at the same time. Marvellous. It comes as close as I can at present to expressing the farewell that I want to wish this house and that mountain. It is a melancholy with which I suspect we are all familiar at some level. Yes. As individuals and as a race, something that haunts us and of which my sadness is only a fragmentary reminder, the feeling of having lost paradise. Now, that last bit is obviously a reference to Paradise Lost, which is the myth this man lives by, that there was once the Garden of Eden and we lost it forever. So he's living in that myth, and it gives his life meaning, so that when he feels that deep wonder, delighted wonder, and also deep sadness, he understands that in the myth that he's living by, it's because we've lost paradise. Yeah. So, the reason I'm telling you all that is because I think there's something of great value in the dualism that Mahayana Buddhism sets up in having a pure land and an impure land. And the impure land is not the pure land. I think there's some value in that. There's obviously some downsides to it as well, but there's also some value in it. And one of the great values, I think, is that the impure land is the imperfect land. The pure land is perfection. So that when we're visualizing, imagining, contemplating the pure land, and especially when we're contemplating the Sangha in the pure land, we're contemplating perfection, the perfection of Sangha, which we can never realize. I remember reading, you remember in the days when Banta used to read a book, and then if he liked it, he would tell us all about it, and we'd all read it. So when I was a member of the Preceptors College Council many, many years ago, one of the books he recommended was Philosophy as a Way of Life by Pierre Hadot, and we actually studied it. Were you there for that Dharma dinner?
Probably.
Yeah. We studied it, or part of it. One of the things I remember about what Pierre Hadot, the book is about ancient philosophy, Western philosophy, as a spiritual path. And one of the things I remember about it was, according to Hadot, the ancient philosophers were lovers of wisdom, and they were trying to achieve wisdom, but it was understood that you never actually got to the goal. Life was just a movement towards wisdom, which but you never actually reached there, which really appealed to me for reasons of my own personality. But I think there's something about having the understanding that this is an impure land, which can prevent us from expecting too much of ourselves, from expecting perfection. And this is a description of perfect Sangha, which I don't think we will ever realize fully, because a perfect Sangha can only happen in a pure land. It can't happen in an impure land. And when we look at our own Sangha, I think what this does is it sets us a goal. Returning to what the scholar Paul Harrison said about the Pure Land, if you remember the first talk, this gives us a new way of reading the text as a template for visualization, etc. What we are left with on the printed page resembles a wiring diagram for a television set, etc., etc. But then a bit later on, he says it's a blueprint. Can't find it right now. Here we are. Thus, we get quite different results if we read the longer Sukhavati Viyuha Sutra, not as descriptions of something already existing, but as blueprints for something which is to be constructed in the mind and then engaged with. Yeah. So you could see this as a blueprint, although a blueprint is not a very good way of thinking about the ideal Sangha, but it's more like an ideal to which we're always aspiring, but we'll never fully realise in this impure land. And that's my belief. And just thinking about this, the Sangha in Pure Land and our order, for instance. The living beings who are born in that pure Buddha field in Sukhavati have no perception of anything as belonging to others, no perception of anything as belonging to themselves. And therefore, he doesn't say therefore, but I think that's what he's getting at. No perception of inequality, no division, no conflict, and no hostility. Yeah? That's not exactly like our order, is it? Especially when you look at Facebook and whatnot. They have minds of equality, minds of loving kindness, gentle minds, affectionate minds, diligent minds, clear minds, stable minds, unhindered minds, unshaken minds, unagitated minds, minds which practice the perfection of wisdom. So that is really something to aspire towards, isn't it? And of course, it's not that we don't have any of that. We do. And sometimes we see, it's almost like we see that the Sangha becomes, or parts of the Sangha become that pure Sangha for a short while, and then they dissolve back into an impure Sangha. So for me, this is quite important. Something else I was going to say there. No, it's gone. But I remember reading a novel a few years ago called The Idea of Perfection. Does anybody know that novel? It's Australian novel. And it's about an engineer, and he's an engineer of bridges, and he's scared of heights, so he can't get many jobs. and he's got this one job at the beginning of the novel in a tiny village somewhere in the outback, and it's a little wooden bridge that is falling to pieces, and he has to go down and fix the bridge. That's the job he's got. And the whole novel is an exploration of imperfection. And this man is a very imperfect engineer of bridges, you know, and he goes down and this bridge is a very imperfect bridge. And the little village is full of very imperfect people. And there's one scene where there's a little garden party one Sunday afternoon, and he's invited because he's, you know, they're really pleased that he's there to fix their bridge for them. And he goes, and, you know, a village is a small place, and a villager turns up who's a real pain, you know, nobody likes him, but of course he's invited because he's part of the village, and everyone just accepts him, you know, he's there and they just accept him. This man, the engineer, comes from a big city, Sydney, I think, and he said in Sydney that man wouldn't have been invited to the party, but here in the village he has to be invited. So it's this sense in which there's this acceptance of imperfection, and I think that's a really, really important thing, that our sangha is imperfect, and that's okay. That's okay. And as we all know, with what's been happening recently, we know that our sangha is imperfect, and that really, really upsets some people. The latest resignation by a Dharmacharini just a couple of weeks ago, wasn't it? I'd never even seen her before, and she gave a number of reasons for her resignation, and one of them was she was profoundly disappointed that this sangha was more or less just like other people, and she didn't expect that. And I thought, oh, what a pity, what a pity that she expected that in the first place. I gave a talk on the 50th anniversary in Birmingham. One of the things I said was, you're going to be disappointed, you know. And that's part of growing up, isn't it? It's part of spiritual development, that what you thought was perfect. And one of the things I said is, when people come along, they're often looking for some kind of perfection. And if you say, don't look for perfection, they'll say, no, of course not, of course not. Because they know, you know, intellectually, they know that that's not really a possibility. But they are, actually. They're looking for perfection. They think, this bunch of people, this is it. And, of course, they're going to be disappointed. In some ways, really big disappointment. And, you know, many of us have been very disappointed, felt very let down. And myself, I left for a good couple of years very disappointed in Sangha Achta Bante. Very angry with him. And it's quite interesting that, because looking back on it, I realised that I needed to do that. I needed to leave. I needed to distance myself from him. But it was after a conversation with him in Tuscany. We were on a retreat, and we'd just been for a walk, and I had to tell him, you know, a number of things. And he was so sweet, and we got absolutely soaked, actually. It poured down on thunder and lightning. It was like the story of the yak horn gone wrong, because there was no yak horn for him to shelter under. We were absolutely soaked to the skin. And then the sun began to shine. We were on our way back, and I thought, I've still got one more thing I have to say to him. I have to say it. Anyway, he was so sweet. And at the end of it, he said, well, keep in touch, won't you? Keep in touch. And I didn't. I left. The next day I left the retreat, before the retreat had ended, and I left the movement soon after that. And I didn't keep in touch. And I think I had to do that, psychologically speaking. But afterwards I realised that I'd broken my samaya vow to him. I'm telling you something now that I meant to say tomorrow in tomorrow's talk. Never mind. Anyway, it's all connected, isn't it? It's about the idea of imperfection. But anyway, so this this description of the Sangha is the Sangha, the perfect Sangha, which we can never be. And I remember once Bhante talking about Homer's Odysseus or Ulysses, and how one scholar had noticed that whenever Homer refers to Ulysses, he always says that great hero. And there's one bit where he's running away from somebody, and that great hero then ran away. And the scholar made the point that that's not really contradictory, because actually on the whole he is a great hero, just not all the time, which I thought was really, really good. So this is the ideal Sangha, and this is one of the on the first day I talked about text being different, that I made the distinction between informative texts and performative. That's one important difference, but there's another difference. I think there's with Anusati texts, I think you have to approach them in a different way than you approach other texts. It's hard to actually study a Buddhanusati text or a Sanghanusati text, because it's just full of wonderful qualities. And all you have to do with a Sanghanusati text is enjoy the quality. What you don't do is compare yourself against it and find yourself lacking. That's what you don't do with Anusati texts. What you do is you contemplate the beauty of that quality, and by contemplating in a positive way, you begin to imbibe the quality. Again, there's something that happened here, maybe last year, I think it was, on our retreat, and Jnana Ketu had asked us to go off in pairs and reflect on something. So I went off with Nichabandu from Poland, chair of Poland, and I decided I was going to reflect on the word upeksha. I don't know why, but I did. And upeksha, and the first thing that happened, because when you reflect in pairs, you speak out loud whatever thoughts are coming in, and first thing that happened was, oh, I'm immediately feeling intimidated and down by this word, because I don't think I've ever experienced upeksha. And that reminds me that I haven't experienced the jhanas, and I don't think I've ever really experienced compassion, and maybe not even metta. You know, one of those things that I do. I don't know if you do that kind of thing as well, but I always do that. So I got that out of my system, and he just sat there waiting patiently. And then I realised, as well as all that, or once that was cleared out of the way, something else was going on, which was a really warm, glowing, golden feeling in my heart. So I got into that then, and I said, "Oh, upeksha, wow, that feels so brilliant. Wow." In other words, I stopped thinking about myself, and I began to just allow the beauty of upeksha to make itself felt in me. And I think that's what we're supposed to do with Sanghanusati text. So that's that bit of the text. And then there's the miracle. I don't know if you followed the miracle, what happened. It's quite hard to follow, isn't it? So if I can, I think I can remember what happens. So then the Buddha, after describing the Sangha there, then he just says to Ananda, "Ananda, stand up, face west, and scatter flowers and prostrate to Amitabha." Now that, I think, I've realised that I think that that is really important, that bit. Because that is the moment when Ananda becomes a Mahayana Buddhist. Yeah, he worships a Buddha other than Shakyamuni, and Shakyamuni orders him to do so. Yeah, so it's like a turning around for Ananda, which I'd never thought about until today. So he becomes a Mahayana Buddhist then, and he worships Amitabha. And what does Amitabha do in response? Light comes from the palm of his hand and lights up the whole great 3,000-fold universe. Everything becomes light. So this is a little bit like that section the two sections I was reading yesterday from the Mahavastu and the Lanza Vistra. The whole universe becomes lit up. So everyone can see everyone else. Yeah. So it's a great miracle of the transcendental bringing about Sangha it's this it's universal sangha. It's what happens. So that happens, and then all the mountains, all those different mountains, and all the walls and the buildings and the trees and everything become almost like flattened to a great ocean. And what is the ocean? The ocean is the Shravakas and the Bodhisattvas. That's what that ocean is made up. It's the Shravakas and Bodhisattvas. So it's the ocean of Sangha. So again, this is, you know, although the Buddha took great pains in describing the beauties of Sukhavati, in the end, what the Buddha, Shakyamuni and Ananda can see is this ocean of Sangha. And then what happens is everyone here can see everyone in the Pure Land, but then everyone in the Pure Land can see everyone here. It's turned round and they're looking at us. Now, I don't know what that means. I don't know what that means. But it seems important to me. It seems really profound that there's this looking that way and they're looking at us this way. Yeah. And if you've had enough, you just go now. Don't feel you have to stay. But there's a little bit I'd like to say about the very last bit of the text, which you didn't hear, because I don't want to overload you. One thing I don't want to do on this retreat is make you have a reaction against the text by overdoing it. So I'm taking it a bit easy, so you go away wanting more rather than, oh, that's enough of that, thank you. So, I'm being a bit careful with how much of the reading we actually do, but the next bit of reading is very interesting, because after that whole section with Ananda, the Buddha then turns to Ajita, the Bodhisattva Ajita, for the first time. Now, Ajita is the Bodhisattva who's going to become in the future Maitreya, the Buddha. So the Buddha, Shakyamuni, says to him, can you see the Pure Land? And he says, yes, I can see it. And he says, can you see the birds? I can see the birds. Can you see this, that, and the other? And he says, yeah, I can see all that. And then he says, can you see the lotuses in the lotus ponds? Yeah, I can. And can you see that some of them are closed? Yeah, I can see that. And can you see some of them open? Yeah, I can see them open. And then Ajita says, why are some of them closed and why some of them are open with beings on and some of them are closed? Why is that? And the Buddha says, it's because the ones in there are beings in the closed lotuses too. And the reason they're in closed lotuses is because of doubt. Yeah. They performed all the actions that they need to, you know, all the roots of virtue and all that kind of thing. They've done that for aeons and aeons and aeons, but they had a doubt about the Pure Land. So they've been reborn there. They've got enough to get reborn there. But the problem with being reborn in a lotus is, although it's wonderful, it's really, really enjoyable, and they're in palaces, flying palaces in the lotuses, so they must be big. So this is the first mention of flying palaces in the lotuses. You actually have flying palaces. They're flying around in these palaces and they're having a great time, except they're enclosed, which means they cannot see the Buddha, they cannot have anything to do with the Bodhisattvas, they cannot hear the Dharma, and they can't see anything in the Pure Land. So they're in, but they're cut off at the same time. Whereas the beings on open lotuses had no doubt at all. So they're right in there immediately. And the beings in closed lotuses is not the end of the world for them, because in 500 years, the lotuses will open and they'll be there. Okay, right. So the Buddha goes on about this for a while. And this is where he says, he uses the image of the king and his son, the prince, and the prince, because of some misdemeanor, the king's thrown him in this prison, but the prison is a prison of luxury. You know, it's got all, you know, jewels everywhere and, you know, couches and cushions and the most beautiful food and dancing girls and all that. It's a really luxurious prison. But the end of that description, the Buddha says to Ajita, do you think, Ajita, it would be exquisitely pleasurable there? Yes, it would be exquisitely pleasurable. And do you think that the prince would be happy there? No, he wouldn't be happy there. And why wouldn't he be happy there? Because he's not free. Yeah, he's got everything you can possibly want except for freedom. So what the Buddha then goes on to say is the beings in the lotus flowers, because of their doubt, they're stuck in those lotus flowers for 500 years and they can't get the Dharma, they can't get the Sangha. And then at the end of it all, he says, do you see, Ajita, what a great waste of time doubt is for bodhisattvas? Yeah. For bodhisattvas, doubt for bodhisattvas. Now, the interesting thing here, I think, something I didn't notice when I was writing the book, so I didn't write this in my book, so a little bit of extra thinking here, is that the beings being born within the lotus flowers don't have doubt in the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. Yeah. They have doubt in the Pure Land. So it's specific. And I was thinking that what the text is getting at is it's when you have doubt in the tradition which you're following. Yeah, that particular tradition. Yeah. Now, there are many people in our tradition who have no doubt at all in Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, but they have a number of doubts about the order and the movement and its efficacy for gaining insight. And that is a great shame for them, I think, because if you've got doubts in the efficacy of this particular movement, but you're involved in it, then you're in a kind of double bind. And it means you cannot give yourself wholly to it. And you're always looking for other things outside the movement which will complement what we haven't got here. And that's why every 10 years there's a new thing that someone brings in and people get very excited about it. Because we haven't got that in the movement. This is the thing that we haven't got. And that's why we haven't yet gained insight. So we'll bring that one in and that will... And as long as we're doing that, we won't be able to give ourselves wholly to the path which we've chosen, or maybe the path which has chosen us.